Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cries the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, brave for guidance. We'll be right back.
Hello, my freaky darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets After Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you're on the right night. But please check out our other After Midnight shows. Fridays are split between Echoes in the Dark and Break On Through with Pam, and Sit In with Fazy and Babble on Saturday as they teach you the fine art of becoming part sinner, part saint. These shows are designed so you can color outside the lines with ritual emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought through pen and voice. So pull up a chair, relax, and open your minds. I'm Rex, and my co-host Pam Ray and I can't wait to get into and read your words. Evening, Pam. What's doing?
Good evening, Rex. How goes it?
All right.
Coolio. Well, I don't know about you, but, you know, I am definitely ready to walk on the wild side. Always looking forward to hanging out with you and other cool poets and, you know, great lineup of poetry tonight, a mix and match of things because missing a couple nights of shows. So all good. How's the weather there in your neck of the woods?
65.
Those are comfortable temperatures. It is a sunny 65 or a cloudy 65?
No, it was sunny today.
Oh, nice, nice. That does make me a little bit envious. Our temperatures aren't really cool, but it's just been cloudy and drizzling like for the past 2 days, but I haven't been able to get out to go for a walk, but I have started pacing around my apartment and doing some stretches and stuff, which I'm sure is driving my downstairs neighbors absolutely crazy, but you know what, that's too bad, because well, if I don't move around, I just get ants in my pants. So I can't wait until we have a sunny day so I can get out and go for a walk. I think I'm going to, as soon as we start getting some nice warm days, I'm going to hit the trails.
All right. Well, I guess we can kick things off with a few bits and pieces.
Aha, I see how it is. Yep, enough chit-chatting. Time to kick things off. All right. Well, first we're going to delve into carryovers from The Big Sleep. And first off, we watered our family tree with whiskey and regret by Son of the Valley. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
We watered our family tree with whiskey and regret by Son of the Valley. Traditions became obsessions while facilitating addiction. Suggested fiction intertwined behind passive-aggressive diction. Repressive genes give unseen reprieves. Tipsy, forgiveness and peace make-believed. Ideologies becomes ingrained deeply within DNA. Genetic remains trained to give dignity away. Uncomfortable, almost indomitable, the regrets of the inconsolable, unsustainable, unbearable, stupid drunk, a distinction quite terrible. Generations of mistaught lessons, for sake of kin, blood is thicker than water unless the liquor makes it thin. Bumbling, grumbling, drugs come back stumbling, debating the real crux, life crumbling, overcome and fumbling, but too stupid to give a fuck. End poem. And they took, you can have a hangover from other things than alcohol. I had one from a woman. All right. What do you think?
I really like this. I thought it has a nice great rhyme and flow, edgy and hard-hitting lines. I like how it spoke on the curse of addiction passed from one generation to the next. Although I did get kind of the idea that it wasn't necessarily from the point of view of the alcoholic themselves, but rather from the point of view of the person who keeps staying in and getting into relationships with alcoholics and other addicts. I could be wrong, but when I see lines like ideologies become ingrained deeply within DNA, DNA genetic remains trained to give dignity away, and then life crumbling, overcome and fumbling, but too stupid to give a fuck. I guess it could be about the drunk itself, but I also see and hear the idea, and I forget what that term is. You know what I mean? The person, the enabler. I feel like there is also not only the voice of the alcoholic, but the addict, but the voice of the enabler within here, and the idea that, you know, what we observe when we grow up as kids is what we see as the norm, what we embrace, and so we see alcoholism, and you know, it becomes a part of us. We see enabling, and enabling becomes a part of us. And there are some great lines almost all the way through, really. But I especially like generations of mistaught lessons for sake of kin. Blood is thicker than water unless the liquor makes it thin. You know, sometimes we just, you know, have to learn to walk away from that blood, learn to walk away from that that environment that we grow up in and create one of our own. So excellent write and very well done.
Nice. Well, that title said quite a bit. We watered our family tree with whiskey and regret. So it hits on the idea of history, not just a single or double generation. Going back a few generations, the idea of living on that back end, tradition, become obsessions while facilitating addiction. The addiction doesn't just have to be the alcohol. It could be a whole mess of addictions, including the obsession of following that tradition, whether it be political or fanatical. It doesn't really matter. It gets handed down and browbeaten. It's the point where there is no way to learn because it does offer up a note of unsustainable, unbearable, regrets of being consolable. You can sit there and hit that note of the TPT angle, blaming the world for everything, yet not getting out of that rut of lifestyle that you've been ingrained in and continue to map out as the next future angle with what you're putting out. So it does become a noted thought to generational lethargy and stupidity moving forward, because there's no there's nothing off the angle on the other side, because one falls into the other one because of what they see. They might roll around abuse, might roll about alcohol, drugs. And you keep following that same tone because you haven't taught the kids how to think outside the box for themselves. So they become what that back end is. Life crumbling, overcome and fumbling, but too stupid to give a fuck. Why? The schools are bad. The parents are bad. Life is hard. And it just walks a natural path of destruction, which usually ends up with jail or death. Unfortunately, but I like this, and thank you very much, Senator Valley, who is, you might remember them as We Are All Gonzo.
Yep. I like that. Great. great observation. Very cool. Very cool. All right. And up next, we have Disillusion by Chinaski, who was nice enough to supply us with a SoundCloud. So here we go.
Tapestry of Disillusion, where saints become rusted signs with bullet holes on the side of the road. My carved mask, holding on to penance, whispering petitions to any god obligated to manufacture dreams in the labyrinth. They bring us home, the seeds of destination, hope rising above long dusted trails, and I kneel in this church, looking at a suspended altar, a shattered ornament in the distance, lighting candles where silhouettes silently hide behind broken wings.
Great read, Chinaski. Thank you for the SoundCloud. Very much appreciated. And he took as honest as you can expect a man to be in a world where it's going out of style. Okay. What do you think about this?
I like it. I'm impressed. As always, it's great to listen to Cal read one of his own pieces. Really amazing imagery and metaphors. I saw this right as two different ways. On one hand, I saw it as finding hope and faith in a broken world. But then I also saw it as the idea that hope and faith itself has become broken. I like the wordplay of the seeds of destination, how he capitalized nation within that. So it's not just the idea of somewhere to be, but pointing fingers at a specific nation or perhaps nation in general, not maybe a specific nation, but perhaps the idea of the human nation falling apart. I really liked my carved mask holding on to penance, whispering petitions to any god obligated to manufacture dreams. I think within those lines, I see the idea of a false sense of hope, and then a shattered ornament in the distance. I thought really made for a great idea of, again, that idea of broken faith. Really powerful, thought-provoking lines throughout, and very well done.
Yeah, I'll roll on the same angle, the tapestry of disillusion, where saints become rusted signs with bullet holes in the side road. I like that note, as well as the whispering petitions to any god obligates to manufacture dreams in the labyrinth. They bring us home, hope rising above long dusted trails. And I kneel in this church, looking at a suspended altar, a shattered ornament. I get the impression of disillusion walks in that note of how far afar we've traveled from the initial thought and teachings in all religions. It's gone to the point. All else. What you got to do is go back in time, look at the Inquisition, the thoughts of drowning out the voice of a different faith just for the hell of it. The Christians in the Colosseum. It hits on the idea of walking too far afield from the originality of faith. And now, well, we're left with little to believe in. It's just a manufactured note of people speaking who don't actually offer up or believe in their own words, yet they make millions. They travel well. They live well. They dine well. Yet those that really believe, the poorest angle of those religions, don't eat, don't live, don't purse themselves well at all except within their beliefs. Yet, they get no help from those leaders.
I like that. Great observations there, Rex.
All right, Dave. Where are we going next?
Well, up next, we have Voyeur by TJ Struska 1, and it goes like this. In the cool, unruffled sheet of night, I spy my neighbor. He marches in his room wearing the sleek mask of a hawk. He stands at his window. A violet plume rises from the dome. The moonlight spills over him like curdled milk. The wind rinses the white glass bulb of his eyes. He moves through the park unseen behind the tree line or the frayed edges of town. There is only this moment. I cower beneath the sheets. His wife returns. She wades through his violet plume. Look, they are dancing, his tongue in her ear. His lungs reek, the personal weather of private hell. I turn to one side, the walls of my room shadowed with pallid air. It was a long night, I said something about the moon, shedding its white on barren fields. There is nothing left but more of the same. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. All right. The Voyeur. That offers up its own intonation. And it almost comes across the dream, except the offering of that note, that third line. I spy my neighbor. He marches in his room wearing a sleek mask of a hawk. Okay. Stands at his window, a violet plume rises from the dome. The moonlight spills over him like curdled milk. There's something almost rude in that note, like curdled milk. The thought of warmth in that moment. And then that almost that thought to transformation. The wind rinses the white glass bulb of his eyes. Then he moves through the park, unseen behind the tree line or the frayed edges of town. There's almost a note to actually taking flight as that that hawk, so to speak. There is only this moment I cower beneath the sheet's fear. And I like that. And then that thought of what they're actually getting into. So you kind of get the impression that this is a youngster trying to actually explain out the moment he sees between the two. And he's doing it in the only way he can. Especially since one, you got the thought of the hawk mask, and then his wife that she waves through his violet plume, the essence of what they are in the moment. Maybe he's got some kind of a costume on. They are dancing, his tongue in her ear. What was it? It was a long night. I said something about the moon shedding its white on barren fields. There is nothing left but more of the same. Sharp contrast between how it starts out and what it dips into on the back end. Something a little different. Something imaginative. And I'm still wondering about the thought of maybe somebody not quite understanding, but yet trying to explain what they're seeing and not really finding the right note, but still offering up what he sees in the moment as something unusual. What about you?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I have to say, I like what you had to say there. I mean, I like your whole comment, but when you had to say at the end about the idea of somebody offering up what they see, but not completely understanding what they see. There were so many thoughts that went through my head as I was reading this. One of the first things I wanted to say to them was, I wish I had neighbors this interesting. But then I realized I might actually have neighbors this interesting. It's just we all keep our blinds closed. So for all I know, my neighbors are wearing hawk masks and, you know, dancing around with purple plumes. But I just can't see them. The one-word title, Voyeur, does give me the idea of someone who is fascinated, of course, with watching people. I have to say, the second stanza, he marches in his room wearing the sleek mask of a hawk. That reminds me of the song Kryptonite by Three Doors Down. You ever seen that video with the old man who's dressing up like a superhero?
Nope. But I'll go go back to the mask of the Black Plague. That walks a very same angle.
Yeah, I could definitely see that too, but... Yeah, definitely. But I'll have to send you that video so you have a better idea of what I'm talking about. But it reminds me of that video and that old man who so badly wants to be a hero. And I have to give kudos to the line, "The moon spills over him like curdled milk." I thought, you know, that's a really clever line because you don't expect such ugliness. But then what I thought is well, maybe this is an older gentleman. And you know how, like, when you get a lot older and, you know, things start to sag and curdle. So maybe the moonlight is revealing the reality of the flesh. You know, I thought that, of course, with the mask and the tongue in the ear and the parading around, there was a certain level of kinkiness in this. So it was really, to me, about the curiosity and kinks of neighbors exposed. And yet I couldn't help but think that also with his lungs reek, the personal weather of private hell, and then the mention of hiding, I cower, there's only this moment, I cower beneath the sheet. That is an act of fear. So it struck me that perhaps there is more to this old man than, and I say old because that's the idea that comes into my head, than just wanting to dress up like a hawk and lick his wife's ear. Maybe there is something almost fiendish or murderous, or maybe another thought that came to my head, and I'm sorry I keep bouncing back and forth, is it actually kind of makes me think of the short story, The Telltale Heart. I think that's the one it was, where the old man gets killed, like the old man who has that creepy eye, and the guy keeps going on about the old man and his creepy eye and how he plans out his murder, and he plans it so perfectly. It reminds me of that. You got to wonder if really the whole problem isn't within the couple and what they're doing together, but with the person who's perceiving them. So, but really intriguing, right? That really gives a lot of food for thought, and very well done.
All right. Where are we going next?
She says, "Hi all. Sadly, today I cannot join the show. I am at host agency where most websites are blocked." Oh, that's a bummer. But hey there, Hats.
Hello, Hats.
She won't be able to hear us, but that's okay. She can listen later. All right. And up next, we have Life, Love, Then the Hangover by Paul D. Fisher, PhD. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Life, Love, Then the Hangover by Paul D. Fisher, PhD. I have noticed the older I get and the closer to my big sleep, the more things give me a hangover. After fighting in the war and coming back with PTSD, I treated it as military men of my era did, with booze. Sometimes between jobs and bouts of success, I would drink three to four quarts of white vodka or rum. So yeah, hangover. As I got accustomed to drink, so I would have little hangover at all. The catch? I couldn't go too long without starting withdrawal. I finally quit because of the medical effects. It came down to life or booze, but I still get up feeling lousy. age apparently gives a mean hangover too. And oh, right, he took the hangover literally on that one. Thank you, Paul. All right, Pam.
Oh, I did enjoy this one. You know, and I thought it had a really good bite to it and a sense of humor. And I found it very relatable because the older I get, the more I find that I just do not recover. I can't drink as much as I used in my 20s, which, thank goodness. You know, I had two beers and half of a Twisted Tea on Saturday at dinner time, and I was asleep by 8 p.m. And it, definitely no more all-nighters, no more binging. So, you know, and I get that. I totally get that. Not only the drinking itself, but as his end line says, age apparently gives a mean hangover too. It's not no longer just about the drinking. It's about the way that our bodies process the alcohol as we get older. And I thought there was, you know, I really like his straightforward language in this, how he touches on the facts and reality of life. And, you know, when he says, I finally quit because of the medical effects, it came down to life or booze, but I still get up feeling lousy. Age apparently gives a mean hangover, too. And isn't that the truth of it all? And, yeah, for a lot of people, there is that idea that whether it's booze or smoking or, you know, switching to a healthier diet, because a lot of times diabetes comes with age, we have to make that choice. We have to give up the vices and become a healthier self, but our bodies don't always agree with that. You know, our bodies sometimes say, do what you want, whatever you want, make all those changes. But guess what? You're old and you're still going to hurt. So great write and very well done.
Yep. Well, PTSD, treated as the military meta biotic with booze. Yes. Later on came all manner of things from heroin to OxyContin to other things. I do remember that even with the booze back in the day, there were other things, Quaaludes, the little red bullets. Those were other forms of treatment as well. But you do what you got to do in the moment. And yeah, that note to the, because of the medical effects that came down to life or booze, kind of hits the idea of the understanding the liver can only take them so much before it becomes enlarged and cirrhotic, and that has its own health functioning notes that you don't really want to dig into. But the age apparently gives a mean hangover too. Yeah, especially if you're running on these binges of 3 to 4 quarts, you're bound to do some falling. You end up with bruising, and over the years, that kind of adds up too. So, and with everything else you do to the body within that note, because you're not eating right, you're sucking down all this alcohol, you're bleeding it out of your system, it's coming out of the pores of your skin, you reek, and all of that has, the effects upon not just your thinned blood, you kill your liver, rot out the kidneys, and all of a sudden you're getting sallow. You might end with a little bit of a yellowing skin because you've done way too much. And life becomes a lot shorter in the moment. But yeah, the idea of life giving you a mean hangover too, all of a sudden you find the body aches more. And it takes a lot more to actually wake up in the morning. And that stretching only leads to more pain because, oh, crap, I slept wrong last night. Can't brush it off easily anymore.
Yep. That is so true.
nice on the literality with this one.
It is. It is. Yeah, definitely. Great fight at literality. That made me think, your comment made me think about how today, and this rarely happens to me, I slept in until 10:30. Like, usually I'm up by about 6, 7 a.m., and I slept till 10:30 and paid the price for that. Like, my mind felt well rested, but laying still for that long really made my back and legs hurt. So, yeah, it's always a trade-off. All right.
All right, where are we going?
Well, up, I'm actually going to put my write up next, which isn't technically a carryover, but it is, I killed two birds with one stone. I just wrote this today, and I wrote it for a contest where you had to use Cockney rhyming slang. But what I did is I was inspired by two of the quotes in your contest, because that contest, you could choose your, like, own inspiration. There wasn't anything specific. So it works with this topic. So this is the red north and south of a gooseberry pudding, and it goes like this. I sat at the rub-and-dub, sipping on the liquid fire of a pimple and blotch. It had been a long, lonesome night of observing a gooseberry pudding. I didn't know her and wasn't sure I ever wanted to. On one hand, she was drop-dead gorgeous with curves that haunted a man's mind with spirits of sin. On the other hand, if rumors had any truth to them, she was a tea leaf responsible for more than one person becoming brown bread. Truth be told, this line of work was no longer my cup of tea. It had become a younger man's game. This was going to be my last job. It had a big payout, and I was short on bread and honey. I needed to get the landlord and a few other collectors off my bottle and glass. She began to approach me. I turned my attention to the heavy-set man banging out a classic jazz tune on the Aunt Joanna. "What's the lemon and lime?" she asked with a voice like the purring tiger stalking its prey. Her mince pies were the color of milk chocolate with an unnerving sweetness to them, and those luscious three-penny bits bounced and swayed with a life all their own. "I haven't a didgeridoo," I responded. "I'm not wearing a watch, but you already knew that, Miss Blake." "Indeed, Mr. Henley," she cooed, "just like I know that you've been having a goosey gander at me all night long. So let's stop with the pork pies. I'll go first. I know you're getting paid to keep an eye on me. He's got to make sure I don't cheat on him. He's also offering you more than a fair price to protect me. But the truth is, Mr. Henley, I grew up on these streets and I know how to protect myself. So you go ahead and tell the boss man that he no longer has to be concerned about the price placed on my loaf of bread. Miss Blake, with all due respect, I can't just be going to my client without proof that the job is done." She slipped a black and white photograph into my palm. "This here should be sufficient evidence. Like I said, Mr. Henley, I know how to take care of myself." She leaned closer, allowing me to take in the sultry and intoxicating scent of her perfume. "As for cheating, I'm a free woman who belongs to no man. But you go ahead and tell our mutual friend whatever he needs to hear in order for you to get your bangers and mash." I smiled at her, figuring whatever unmarked grave I ended up in, this woman was definitely worth the zigzag. "Well," I said, "now that we have that settled, how about we drink a couple of cold pig's ears and find ourselves a hot game of rats and mice?" She smiled back with the loveliest red north and south I had ever admired. "Mr. Henley, I very much enjoy a good game, especially when the stakes are high." End poem, or story, or whatever you want to call it.
Yes. And would you like to say something about this before we do?
Well, I tried to use as much Cockney rhyming slang as I could, which Cockney rhyming slang didn't mean, like, the contest itself said the poem could be in either rhyme or free verse as long as you use Cockney rhyming slang, which is basically they take usually either one phrase, most likely like either a single word, but oftentimes a phrase of 2 to 3 words, and it means something else. And usually the thing it means is it rhymes with, not all the time, but most of the time. Like a rub and dub is a pub, a pimple and blotch is a scotch, a tea leaf is a thief, bottle and glass is ass. I won't list them all, but I did make sure to put in the in the AN, I put in the different phrases that I used. And I was inspired by the quote, "She approached me with enough sex appeal to stomp a businessman's lunch. And I didn't have anything exciting to drink like nitroglycerin or distilled tiger's breath." I thought about making the main character a woman, the protagonist a woman, but I decided I wanted to go with a male protagonist, which I thought about having you read, but then I was like, well, no, because I need Rex to read another one here. But yeah, and I also thought about going with the Cockney accent, but then I thought, well, I don't always pull those off really well. Plus, I kind of wanted to give it, like, I wanted to slightly connect with the idea of the American, you know, private dicks, or although this case he's not really just a private detective. There's, you know, he does other jobs as well, so usually like more unsavory jobs. But it was fun to write. It was fun to create. It might be one of those where, you know, I might continue on with the characters and see what happens. But knowing me, I'll just get lost in something else. So, yeah, well, that's all I can think to say.
Okay, well, the title says quite a bit. The Red North and South are gooseberry pudding. Obviously, the gooseberry pudding being the woman, but the Red North and South offers up 2 flavors. I did like the note to the slang offered up. And for most people, it's easy enough to follow along. Some of it you might have to look up, like the pimple and blotch, but everything else kind of hits on the ease of note, especially what comes out, the gooseberry pudding, the becoming brown bread, as well as what was that, bottle and glass. That was an easy touch. So, yeah, there's an ass in there somewhere. The Aunt Joanna, I thought that was a good one, the piano. That was a nice, easy one to hit on. The lemon and lime was a little bit difficult, although that does walk out to coming up with time. But I did like the thrippany bits bounce and sway with a life all their own. That was an easy one, transferable too. So that worked out pretty good. But I haven't heard that one before, thrippany bits. And this kind of had me thinking is this the other side of Sweeney Todd? Have we walked into another one of those? Especially with the sweetness to the pies that you dropped in there.
I like that. Yeah. Well, yeah, they're both, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I had meant it to be the underlying idea that they were both killers. Like, he was paid to kill the guy that was after her, but the picture she had handed over was supposed to be of the guy that she had already killed. I just didn't want to go into too many details, but yeah. I like that you picked up on that general idea. And I don't know, well, shoot, no, I was going to say it's too late. It closes in 2 hours. I had actually sent you this contest link, Rex, thinking that you would have fun with it. But it looks like it's going to close in 2 hours. But, you know, maybe.
Well, I ain't gonna make that one.
Yeah, nope. But definitely, I mean, you know, if you ever feel inspired, it's really fun to play with the Cockney rhyming slang if you get a chance to do that.
All right,
I'll go ahead and grab the next one and do. Up next, we have Shake Me Dean Martini by Peter Solway. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Shake Me Dean Martini by Peter Solway. 1, 2, 3. Testing. Well-used microphone. Glands of memories. Prophecies. Plural angels recording. Tap now. Rack. Silver skins of reception. ABC. Perforations of communications. Satellite bound. Round and round. Ancient narrator recording. Hindu heaven sign. Samuel. A bit too much under the influence. Signed T.S. Need to talk. Retired Dix. Life, no profit. All over the Ingrid Bergman shop, new mate. Wanting slopes of snow and slip. Fur deck ducks to stoke. Get them paddling past breakfast. Colorful tales as usual. A leap back in sing-along time. Narrated dream of propulsion. Private jet airlines. Evening by the fire. Televised crimes and Colosseum vision, lapwit dinner served by Nero's mother, rape and murder, which came prior. Ancient glut of suspects on the big screen, now fossils of evidence, bandstand. Brian, what's his name? Once a working brain. Oh, serial nail biters, bedwetters, the twilight zone. Nurse apocalypse, shaking me awake, asteroid zooming in, announcing in Martian, Latin, my Dean Martini hour. Switch programs. Favorite salami. Breasts of mafia recompense. Sicilian birth. Mountains of succeeding beginnings. But blunt-horned Atlas. Wheelchaired bound. Orbit zeroing down. Another of gravity's mugs. Wheel me around. Failures of death sentence. Falling from nurse milk. A new name and look for pretty. Gotta ask. Wanna be Detective Rich's private secretary? Cover all cases together, dust fresh fingerprints, solve problems like Sicilian doctors cure cancer. Undercover cowboy, pretend actor on steep slopes, once in black and white outfit, more handsome than a fence post. Cows and horses on the tonal box, lightning strikes of last residence. In the sunrise nursing establishment, death hanging around, bad smell, probably mine, Agent 99, changing my nappy, sublime. Madonnas of alpine milking, Heidi Airlines to return, with dad and paper so thin, meaning fine, prayers in the luggage compartment. Aluminum, exchanges of the future crashing, Stalin with a better plan, winged socialism, happy communes, slogans of the leaded horizon, Ansel Kiefer, some German. Polio lad with smaller legs back then, one testicle larger than the other, an uncle who loved him, filthy mother, proper sister or whatever, curious ambitions, soldiering and smoking, adult life entering. Geisha nurse, Jap curse, channel changing by Port Morse, old gunner back in the khaki shorts, emigrating north, Texas, well-oiled, private eye with John Lalotte, registered sidearm, holster of belt, spit of snot. Swiss telescope and tan dame, fingering his appointments in order, porn of Sussex, muse of Rembrandt, real winnings in outback Vegas, even without gold frame. Make Arnold McWhirter wish he was the writer, Salman Rushdie forever, sprouting mushroom, small caliber, wishing was an American with advanced firepower. But outsell away, below the heated equator, belt of humid heat, at the podium darkness, and even more char-grilled subcontinent natives of sunken blubber and bones. Adultery not uncommon in these sunken realms. sand dunes of precaution still slipping. There was a Wanda, holdings with parkas flashing. Used to hunt them all down, find out what they weren't doing in bedrooms. Deaf nurse no longer listening, concerned with thoughts of boyfriend. Tall, tiptoe reception. Maybe she's a lesbian. All this modern living, circuit waves still crashing, unveiled, wishing a profession. Daddy Taliban, St. George, and drug-free stallion, Trojan mare of Helen, surf again and again, verse of headlines, war weathering, gulls crying. End poem. I think Peter saved that one up.
Yeah, right? He really did, because his last couple of ones were brevities, and then all of a sudden he just unloaded. Wow. I have to say, great read there, Rex. Yeah, I just thought this was great. As always, it's got Peter's biting sense of humor to it, edgy, hard-hitting lines, brilliant imagery and metaphors. I like how it makes me think of the dreams and nightmares of a nursing home resident. But there's also so many other thoughts that go through my head. Wonderful lines all the way through. I thought the reference to retired dicks, you know, retired private detectives and Ingrid Bergman was great because it fit really well with the theme of the contest. And then the idea of a society of, you know, just like darkness. And, you know, when he mentions Nero's mother, where he says, televised crimes and Colosseum vision lap with dinner served by Nero's mother, rape and murder, which came prior. I thought that was a great reference that brought to my mind the idea that behind every like so-called evil dictator is a mother who both raised and influenced him. In fact, throughout history, you'll often find that people who were considered evil, though I have read that Nero might have not have been quite as bad as people thought, although I'm not saying that he was a saint, obviously. But oftentimes there is that influence of the mother. And Nurse Apocalypse makes me think of that Nurse Ratched. Nurse Apocalypse shaking me awake, asteroids zooming in. But it also makes me think of the eclipse today and the idea of, you know, people going into a panic that it was going to be another end of the world. And favorite salami, I just thought that was a great double entendre. You know, I think every Nurse Apocalypse needs a favorite salamis. That actually kind of made me think of your series that you used to write, The Loon. I don't know why, but for some reason that it just came to my mind reading about Nurse Apocalypse and a favorite salami. You know, I feel like what's happened here is we're into the mind of someone who used to spend all their time reading those detective novels with all those unsavory characters. And now they're at the nursing home, and there's nothing but that fantasy life and those same unsavory characters have become the reality of their madness. Really great lines all the way through. And I have to say, another part that I really also like was adultery not uncommon in these sunken realms, sand dunes of precaution, still slipping hills of Wanda, Holden's with Parkers flashing. That made me think of the movie A Fish Named Wanda. But great lines all the way through and very well done.
Yes. All right. Thank you. The note, Shake Me Dean Martini, the idea that that wasn't actually real. That was part of Martin's shtick. He ran that thought of being the affable drunkard on stage as part of his, how he communicated, how he got his laughs across. He wasn't actually drunk, which is kind of funny. So this kind of hits on the idea, 1, 2, 3, testing, well, use microphone, plans and memories, prophecies, plural angels recording, tap, now rap. The idea of gaslighting, of using silver skin, of reception, ABC, narrator reporting. We got everything is being, this whole thing is designed to get you to walk into that arena and be enlivened to the point where you believe, because you got the televised crimes in Coliseum Vision, Lackland Dinner, Sir Paneer's Mother Rape Murder, which came prior. The idea of all that, which nobody knew much about unless it was done to them in the moment, is now a televised monster, which has shoved down everybody's throats. The idea on the back end with the that thought of being in the nursing home, yes, I nurse apocalypse, yeah, Ratchet. But then again, having 99 wiping his ass, so to speak. The idea of, oh, yeah, I remember back in the day, I used to watch Get Smart. 99, she was a good one. She can wipe my ass even though she's not here. What else we got here? Sicilian doctors cure cancer. The tonal box. What is this? There's a lot in here. Oh, there was another note too. What was it? He even dropped in. Let's see where. Texas, well-oiled private eye with John a lot. Registered sidearm, holster, belt. It was smart. But there was make Arnold Macware. Is that a note to Schwarzenegger? But he also drops in a thought. Salman Rushdie, forever spreading a mushroom. Small caliber, wishing he was American. With advanced firepower. Yeah, Salman Rushdie, he wrote that book. I can't remember the name of the book now. But he had a price on it, and I think he still does. He's been in hiding ever since from the Arab world because of the book he wrote. Then there was Holden's with Parker's flashing. I like that because Holden's are it's an Australian car manufacturer. So that was a nice touch. And I too thought that note of Wanda Vision. And what else we got here? And again, too, that thought was, what was it? Damn it. The martini angle kind of hinted at a little bit of a 007 intrigue, because it does offer up the note of shaken, as well as hitting on Dean. But what else we got? The back end of this, Daddy Taliban, St. George, and drug-free stallion, Trojan Mare of Helen, surf again and again, verse of headlines, war weathering, gulls crying. Okay, war weathering, gulls crying. The gulls, for me, kind of hits on the idea of the news people. Yes, we've got to go to war. Yes, start the machine. And you know what? It's funny because Estonia just put out something the other day about England. Hey, you might want to start getting those conscriptions in order since you're going to be stepping on the field soon enough. And the funny thing is, we've already got it here ready to go, yet nobody's talking about it because they know that people won't have it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Insane. But really great observations there, Rex. Yeah. Salman Rushdie has definitely had death threats, including a fatwa calling for his death issued by Ruhollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran. And Then also, and he was actually, and I remember what is happening. In fact, I had even questioned whether or not he was still alive, but apparently he is. But back in 2022, he was stabbed after a man rushed onto the stage where the novelist was scheduled to deliver a lecture.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yep. Yeah, I had too. I just couldn't remember for some reason whether he had lived or died. But I did remember reading that story about him being stabbed. So, yeah. And definitely a fascinating and, you know, right by Peter for sure. And I like all that you took away from that. Well.
Oh, he wrote the satanic verses. That was what I couldn't think of. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, okay, yep. Yeah, whenever you start messing with people's religions, and they don't like that, especially extremists, but yeah, that's for sure. But that was the end of Carryovers from the Big Sleep, which I thought was a great contest, and I'm looking forward to what you come up with for next week, Rex. And so now, because we weren't able to do the show on Friday, the Echoes in the Dark show, because of Blog Talk being down, we are going to go into Carryovers from The Wild Hunt, which was from Echoes in the Dark. And so I'll go ahead and put up that first. Right? And
Wild Hunt, where's that?
Oh, The Wild Hunt?
I thought it was the last day of the campaign.
Okay. The first carryover we have from that is Wicked Hunt by Betty Page. Bolts of lightning strike, dark, ominous clouds looming. Wicked Hunt begins, hoofs of beasts stampede, high demons and hounds of hell, vicious eyes ablaze, sharpened blades slash fierce, swiftly piercing naked flesh, dripping in crimson, bloodthirsty devils, eerie howls of wolves frightened, neath the full moon, gnashing of fangs grind, icy cool breeze chilled to bone, biting consumes flesh, battles just begun, precursor, impending doom, awakens lost souls, bolts of lightning strike, dark, ominous clouds looming, wicked hunt begins, hoofs of beasts stampede, high demons and hounds of hell, vicious eyes ablaze, sharpened blades slash fierce, swiftly piercing naked flesh, dripping in crimson. End poem.
Great read, man. Damn, Betty's got a little dark. It's kind of walks on that note of berserkers going absolutely blood ritualized in the moment. Vicious eyes ablaze, sharpened blades flash fierce, swiftly piercing naked flesh dripping in crimson. Bloodthirsty devils, eerie howls of wolves frightened, meet the full moon. That had me thinking of berserkers. Then again, she rolls into gnashing of fangs grind. Icy cool breeze chills the bone, biting consumes flesh. Okay, yes. Take the flesh, consume it. They are now a part of you. The hooves of beasts stampede, high demons and hands hell. Hey, when you got all that whooping going on and all that screaming and that growling, you know what? It might sound like the hounds of hell and the high demons coming for you, but it's just a bloodthirsty lot of berserkers gone mad. I like it. Something different from Betty.
Absolutely. Well, you know, considering it was written for a dark show, I thought she, it went, worked really well, and especially with the theme. And just to remind people, the theme was the Wild Hunt, which is a widespread motif in European folklore. And it, throughout Europe, a belief existed in a folklore that a group of spectral riders went forth at night on the hunt. The Wild Hunt was a portent of catastrophe and could bring death to those unlucky enough to witness it. Oftentimes, you would have either historical leaders or mythological figures, Odin being the most common, leading the hunt. Yeah, I really like the direction that Betty took with this. I thought she really captured the imagery of this spectral hunt from hell. I like the idea that with the, where she says, hoofs of beasts stampede, high demons and hounds of hell, vicious eyes ablaze. So here's this spectral event that has come from the deepest, darkest pits of hell. And I like that she says high demons, the idea that there's a hierarchy amongst the demons. I thought it was also, so I thought this was a great write by Betty. And I also thought it was really cool that you happened to mention berserkers, because I actually have bookmarked some artwork and some websites that have to do with the different types of berserkers in Nordic culture and Viking culture, but also in others, because I'd eventually, I didn't want to do it too closely to the Wild Hunt, but I would like to eventually run a contest and do a show on berserkers for a dark show.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Betty fits the berserker thought anyway.
Yeah, I like that, though. It does have that kind of crazy feel to it, about the wild berserker, the vicious eyes ablaze. So, very cool. And up next, we have The Hunt by Silent Tree. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
The Hunt by Silent Tree. Bone horns trumpet the hounds of hunger. Rogue scent of blood roses perfume the air. The feral thirst, a nocturne incense of ivory. Pale whispers on tongues of bated breath. Cloven hooves plague a tattooed landscape. Drum footprints cleft dusk's canopy parade. A blight hangs on rusted blades of autumn. Regal pursuits to hunt sacred fruits of flesh. Pagan altar, athame, lustrated lamb sacrifice. Sown vestal lips bestow a silence to seasons as fiery chariots rode violent mercurial skies, neath triumphal arches lay ashes of victory. A rose, fingernails, furrow of dusty chalkboard, glazed eyes pierced naked leather tapestries. Willow winds will silence the dance of raindrops, swan songs ricochet rains of plateau skin. Dragoon riders harvested the macabre mirage, burnt by wooden effigies of ruinous mimicry. Prophets drifted serpent rivers of desert grain. Nomad reveries fade afore the gates of dawn. Foreign shadows graze the prairie lunar labyrinth. Chased whiskers bathe buried catacomb trails. teeth of claret lacerate limbus jigsaw bodies, cast awful offerings into throats of the abyss. To yield mortal fragments of thine great divine, painted palm print shape oracles to mankind, bonfires echoed ages, stone statuettes survive, wild hunts begin as marble memorials decline. And Paul. All right, what you got?
Well, great read there, Rex. This is quite the epic rite. You know, amazing imagery throughout. She paints this great word picture with her choices of words, and some nice use of imagery and a gentle touch of alliteration throughout. I really like where she says, cloven hooves plague a tattooed landscape, drum footprints, cleft dusks, canopy parade, a blight hangs on rusted glades of autumn, regal pursuits to hunt sacred fruits of flesh. The idea that I think those lines especially speak on the idea that with the wild hunt comes those unnatural desires, but also the idea that death is to follow right behind it. When you are a witness to you know, such an event, you know, you are said to be doomed. I also like that she brings in the dragoon riders. I thought that was very cool. Wonderful. You don't see the word dragoon, you know, meaning like a soldier, used very often. And I thought that was really cool there. And then the mention of the prophets. Prophets drifted serpent rivers of desert grain, nomad reveries fade afore the gates of dawn. So there's not only, I think, to me anyways, the idea that there's that mythological wild hunt, but rather the storming in of the soldiers taking over a people's land. I also think that comes through in where the end lines, with bonfires echoed ages, stone statuettes survive, wild hunts begin as marble memorials decline. That idea that the wild hunt isn't necessarily the mythological, but rather the reality of a people who are being killed off by war and violence when they're just trying to live their own peaceful life. Wonderful dark rite and very well done.
Right. I did like that second last stanza. Something, it's primal. Foreign shadows graze the prayer lunar labyrinth. Chased whiskers bathe buried catacomb trails. Teeth of claret lacerate limbus jigsawn bodies. Cast awful offerings into throats of the abyss. And teeth of claret, I like that. And the note of chaste whiskers, something pure in the moment, but not really, considering where they're going to be dropped in. But the lacerate limbus jigsawn body, there's a picture. Something quite serene in the moment. Cast awful offerings into throats of the abyss. Awful offerings. Yes. Ripped bellies, guts, and intestines, and all manner of that which once was tethered beneath the skin is now shared across the landscape. I like that. That's a nice picture right there. The dragoon riders, obviously the macabre mirage. Another, I like that one too. Let's see what I forgot here. Pagan altar, Athema, lustrated lamp sacrifice. The Athema, the double-edged pagan knife. I like that. And the fiery chariots rode violent material skies. And the triumphal arches lay ashes of victory. Ooh, this is full of delicious imagery. But that second line stanza, got to take that one as the top piece. So nicely done, Starlet. All right.
All right. Well, up next we have At Night by Grant G. At night within a different world, growls, barks, biting, screams. Trees are black, grass is gray, not much sunlight during day. Clouds are vast, rolling over dark purple sky. Thunder, thunder, lightning cracks. Shadow people, orbs and ghouls are fact and eerie sense intact. Blood drips from every plant or clings because congealed. Forest dark, meadows vast, this land is more than real. Twigs snap where they stand, crazy howling screams. Then they charge across gray meadow vast as if flying out death's trees. Teeth, knives, axes, bite, cut, stab, and slash. Blood spurting into breeze. A scream and gasp, a wee boy wakens out this maddest dream. End poem.
Great read, man. But is it the maddest dream? Because kind of this reminds me of what happened to the lost Roman legion that disappeared into the hinterland, the forest of the Germanic tribes in Europe, going back, God, almost 2,000 years now. Completely wiped out the entire legion. At night, a different world. You got the wolves, and you got bears and everything else rolling around those days. Yet these guys, they didn't leave a man alive. They killed everybody to a T, stripped them off their metalworks and their swords, and just left the bodies to rot in the forest. I think it took the Romans a while. They came back, I forget the story about how they knew where it was, but it was a massive note to they knew the forest, they knew the trees, they knew the realm. They took advantage of that as the Romans were walking through it, trying to get from one end to another and take more territory. Yet they never made it out. They got swallowed whole. So that just reminds me of that flying out death's trees, teeth, knives, axes, bite, cut, stab, and slash, hurting into the breeze. I like that. Nicely done.
Very cool. Yeah, I can definitely see that. He really does, you're right, take us back in time. I have to say I really like this one. The not only the fact that he takes us back in time, but how dark and visceral the imagery is. And, you know, throughout, there's this just brilliant, dark, visceral imagery, and then the way he wrapped it up with the end lines, a scream and gasp, a wee boy wakens out the maddest dream. So you can almost see this as being the idea of the dream of a child's overactive imagination, coupled with the idea of how every sound, every sight changes when it becomes dark, when it's the shadows that are wrapped up in moonlight and darkness, or the sounds of a storm, the animals howling outside. I remember when I used to live out in the country and you'd hear like wolves and coyotes howling, and it's beautiful sounding, but it's also eerie. But the other thought I had of this was that, you know, it's that thought of a child remembering a past life, or maybe a current life. Maybe it's the child is the monster itself. But I kind of get the idea of, like, just the fear that's held within a child, either because of the imaginary monsters or the real monsters that they face. And this has some great imagery all the way through, but I like how he also brings sound in with twigs snap where they stand, crazy howling screams. But I also really like the imagery of blood drips from every plant or clings because congealed. That idea that no part of nature can escape the destruction. So excellent dark right and very well done.
All right.
Well,
so, I guess we got a new person on the board. L.A. Oh, Labluski.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, hello, Labluski, and I see Zach. Hello, Zach. Good to see you both. Thank you for hanging out on the board. Very cool. Well, the next rite we have up is Through the Maddened Red by Captain Kerr. And go ahead, please rest and give that a read.
Through the Maddened Red by Captain Kerr. They fell like clouds that stray for warring skies, in massive hordes and bloodstained crashing hoofs. Proud virgin brides with iron lance and spear, flanked to the right in quick commanding lengths, black steeds descend with riders on the prowl, red capes atop the breeze, on sheath, sword in hand. Lithizanas lead sunrise to the cusp, under smoky graves where the shadows sleep. Goslar slumbers deep. Like an angry mule, bolts of lightning kick, thick blasts of thunder fuel the rampage on the ground, and through the dreary mist, one sounding horn, with deep breath echoes sown, swirls around the field. Pipes and drums are quelled, till the lowlands fill with high-pitched notes of Baldur underhunt. Straight up the thick veined silver mountains, rumbling shocks are heard where the shadows sleep. Goslar slumbers deep. In avalanche of song, 10,000 riders swell and crest upon the hill that choke the mountain's neck. Grumbling from the depths where magma circles wide and crimson rivers fill. Persimmon scents the air, lilacs dress the plain, fall is gowned in silk, rearing horses rein, sweating from their brow, when Thunrise lifts his arm and drops it to his side. Through the mad red they charge, Goslar wakes in fright. The rundling village skies are clear while Kathy feeds her goats. First light above the hard steels down the winding slopes. Flush river valleys gleam, awaiting golden dawn. Kathy twirls her golden locks and sights a speck of fawn. Close abreast the wooded scene, a black fog gone amiss. A dark cloak rider swerves his stride, thundering through the mist. In whirlwind funnels, sudden gasp, churning from the west. Balder reaches down to save and plucks Kathy from her nest. And bum.
Great read, Rex. I was definitely looking forward to hearing that in your voice. There was a lot of great rites in this contest, some of which I wish I could have placed, but I have to say that I thought this one worked so very well with the topic because I actually put in, like, I think two or three pieces of artwork that had to do with the topic of the wild hunt, plus a poem, or I told people they could just write on the general theme. Like I provided a link from mythologysource.com. Captain Kerr, I gave him gold, and he wrote the header picture, which was painted by Peter Nikolai Arbel. And I thought, you know, there was just such a wonderful flow to this. like, it wasn't necessary, like, it was not only the some of the rhyme that you see in here, but the word choices and the attention to detail. That, and I thought there was a real classic feel to this poem that fit well with the classic artwork. And I thought it was really cool that he put in his AN some of the word choices that he had used, like Thunraz being Odin, the North God, and Baldur being Odin's son. Lippin's Honors being the white steed. A lot of a great attention to detail. And like I said, very epic feeling. And I like how he brings us into the Norse mythology. And I have to say that I really thought this was great all the way through, but like one of my favorite parts was when he says, like an angry mule, bolts of lightning kick, thick blasts of thunder fuel the rampage on the ground, and through the dreary mist, one sounding horn with deep braved echoes sound, sown, swirls around the field. Pipes and drums are quelled till the lowlands fill with high-pitched notes of Baldur on the hunt. So it connects the lightning and the thunder with the mythology of the Norse gods, especially particularly Odin and his son Baldur. And I thought that was really great and just an excellent write and very well done.
Nice. Those first three stanzas were kind of the kickoff, so to speak, because you write Gothwas slumbers deep for the first two of end lines. And then the third one hits on Goslar wakes in front. The village finally wakes to the sounds of what's going on. So the first two stanzas hit on the idea of the beginning of what's coming. It hasn't got there yet. It's just mounting. They fell like clouds that strike a warring sky in massive wars and bloodstained crashing hoofs. So you got the buildup. It's that third one, the last stanza, which walks a very different tone, also because it rhymes and flows on a different tone. The rumbling village skies are clear while cafe feeds their goats. First light above the horse steals down the winding slopes. Plush river valleys gleam, awaiting golden dawn. The cafe twirls some golden locks in sight with speckled fawn. Close abreast of wooded sea, a black fog gone amiss. A dark cloaked rider swerves astride, thundering through the mist. In whirlwind funnels, sudden grass, churning from the west, Baldur reaches down to save and plucks cafe from her nest. So I kind of hit from the idea that soul, that singular soul rescued in the moment, kind of offers up that tone to what happens afterwards. Does she become part of the new age moving forward? Does Baldur being Odin's son, does she move into that realm and birth the next generation of godlike beings? So that last one reads on that epic note of the rhyming piece that you want to keep the flow going well, while the first three offer up what is going on in the moment until you get to that plane on the last stanza itself. So nicely done, Captain.
I like that. You know, I really like what you had to say about the two gods, Odin and his son, being that representation of violence passed down from one generation to the next. Very cool. All right. Yep, I am grabbing the next one. Slowly but surely. All right. And up next we have Ghostly Night and the Nightmares by Dr. Human for Humanity. And it goes like this. The advent of the night comes in silence, just like a ghost comes through nightmares, just as if a curtain dropped from the heaven and all the scenario is absolutely hidden. All the ghostly people of the nighttime comes and do their inhibited crimes, threatens the people who are excessively afraid. They come in groups to raid. The sorcerers come with some magic sticks, with an environment of fearsome tricks. The children are afraid of the darkness. They quickly find their mom's laps to take rest. Their parents are also afraid, not less. They pray to their god and goddess so that they can find mercy and blessings and get a better environment, which is fearless and calm.
Great read, Pam. Kind of walks back a little bit in time or to those outer reaches where the convenience of today for most of the world does not exist. This walks in that note of fires in the open, everybody huddled around the fire, the tales that get handed down from generation to generation, that note to the fire itself being what keeps out those things that is feared in the darkness. As you get that note up right at the top, the advent of the night comes in silence, just like a ghost comes through nightmares, just as if a curtain dropped from the heaven and all the scenario is absolutely hidden. That's the idea of the utterly no pure darkness, the blackness. Nothing shines through, no starlight, like a cave. You're outside the realm of that which your senses can tolerate in the moment. And because of that, comes with that the idea of that which crawls, that comes with our lizard brain. What crawls in the darkness is what we fear because we used to have to hide from it because it crawled in the darkness. We didn't have that note to the ever-present luminosity of electricity or even fires that burn brightly in the night because you didn't want that much smoke, but you did want the warmth. And you got this idea, the thing of a sorceress and magic sticks. Those were things that we hit upon as to explain that which we couldn't explain and still do to today in some places on Earth. So I like the note, the thing of that ancient era of where things were still traded on, where things were still told, where things were still practiced around that little tight-knit group around the fire because your lives depended on it.
I like that. Sorry, I have a frog in my throat, and I had to get it out. I thought this was a great write, wonderful observations there. And, I really liked this one and the tone that it carried. It was dark, but it wasn't super dark. I think what it does, at least for me, is it reminds us that darkness exists, that there is a battle between good and evil, but that the battle isn't necessarily always a physical one. Sometimes it's a spiritual one. And I thought this was an excellent write on the darkness that brings fear to young and old alike, and the comfort found within prayer. I especially liked in the ending where they said their parents are also afraid, not less. They pray to their gods and god and goddess. I thought those are really great lines to remind us that courage isn't the absence of fear, which I know is a paraphrasing a quote, but rather, moving forward while still being afraid. I also like the mention of the sorcerers come with some magic sticks with an environment of fearsome tricks. I think those lines there work really well to speak on the idea that too oftentimes when the powers that be try to control a society, they try to do so with fear. So, you know, great writing and very well done.
All right. What do we got?
All right. Well, I'm going to take a little turn. That was the end of that contest. And before we go into rights from the last day of Pompeii, which was another dark contest, I had one carryover left from our last break on through show. And that was Best Affair by Poeta de Cabra. And it was written for the Norman Lindsay contest to the quote, "The best love affairs are those we never had." And if you would give that a read, please, Rex.
"The Best Affair" by Poeta de Cabra. "The best love affair, or so it seems, is the one we have in our dreams. We can romance a princess or a queen, or perhaps someone off the silver screen. Imaginary lover is always content, and never is there an argument. Ask her to marry her, says yes, of course. Happy forever, no chance at all of divorce. Lots of romance, joy and laughter, stay deeply in love forever after. Always time for a hug or a loving kiss, and a love making is absolute bliss. In real life, who knows what to expect? Some relationships great, but not perfect. I'm not complaining, though. No regrets. My marriage is probably as good as it gets. But sure as the sun and moon are above, most people do fall in love, then out of love. Person you meet just seems right for starters. Soon find out it's hard to find perfect partners. Maybe husband and wife, but still, it ends. For at the last, you need to be the best of friends. Give and take. Have fun. Lots of laughs. Don't mess about, do things by halves. Some people sneak around, lie and deceive. Why have an affair if not happy, then just leave. Best to move out, split up, but do it amicably. Telling you from experience and emphatically. Certainly no marriage counselor or expert, but over the years, I've seen many people hurt. People have affairs because relationship isn't ironclad. I think the best affair, though, is the one we never had." End point.
Great read there, Rex, and an excellent write by Poeta de Cabra. I'm glad he shared this with us and was inspired to write. You know, as always, Poeta is a great rhyming poet and manages to balance out a serious message with a sense of humor. Like there is a serious message to this, and the idea of how difficult relationships can be to handle, and how when we go into marriage, we can never be 100% sure of how things are going to turn out. I love the humor in "Imaginary lover is always content, and never is there an argument. Ask her to marry you, says yes, of course. Happy forever, no chance at all of divorce." And, oh, isn't that the benefits of having that imaginary lover? But alas, you know, life is filled with reality. And he also has some great words of wisdom, you know, where he says, maybe husband and wife, but still it ends. For it to last, you need to be the best of friends. Give and take, have fun, lots of laughs. Don't mess about, do things by halves. And that is such great words of wisdom, especially I think when it says, you know, like you, it has to be that balance of give and take, and that you have to be able to laugh together. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
Thank you. Oh, interesting, man. He did this in sections. Those first three stanzas walk on that note of the dream itself, the quote, and play off that angle. Then the fourth line rolls in real life, who knows what to expect? Some relations great, but not perfect. I'm not complaining, though, no regrets. My marriage is probably as good as it gets, note to reality. And then that walks through the next three sounds, the three stanzas walking that same thought. Then he comes right back around to that opening salvo in that last line. I think the best of there, though, is the one we never had, which finishes off the thought he had with the first three stanzas of the dream angle, the note to the silver screen, no chance of divorce, the lovemaking is absolutely bliss, the perfect notion of reality that can't exist because there is no perfect notion of reality. It's just a novel idea that one keeps within their head. And like it says, the one we never had. Hey, in perfection comes that thought, you can't have it because it wasn't real. But then again, I never had it to begin with, so what's the big deal in having the notion?
Absolutely, absolutely. We cannot expect, you know, perfection from each other. So great comment there. All right, and now we're going to go into rites from the last day of Pompeii contest, which we won't get through them all, so any carryovers we have, I have two full of a board for Thursday, so we'll probably, as long as it's okay with you, Rex, put them on next Tuesday, because I'm sure we're not going to get through them tonight. Okay. But it was an 8 spots only contest, and it was the prompt was simply one painting, The Last Day of Pompeii by Carl Brielov, and I probably butchered that name, but that's okay. And first one I'm going to put up is called The Last Days of Pompeii by Gary Rubin. Who was nice enough to supply us with a SoundCloud. So let me hunt that down. There we go.
The Last Days of Pompeii by Gary Rubin. Rain, a fickle lover can't be forecasted. Risque dance floor dances, practiced in the shower. Off-key songs sung, meant for nobody. Overheard. Fall leather home shopping network pants, Euro chick size that grandma purchased. Little boys caught fireflies frozen in baby food jars, useless as young women applying makeup before workouts. Homeless vagrant stoplight terrorists are paid a dollar not to smear windshields with oily cloths. Mercedes-driven children, butlers serve trick-or-treaters at mansions, but emaciated migrants wait in line for a bowl of gruel. Anxiety worries about paper or plastic decisions, texting drivers, and those objects in the mirror appearing closer than they seem. Asleep at the wheel, running big decision, red lights, overthinking, should obsessive-compulsive be hyphenated? Titanic captains focused on enough ice to continue shaking martinis. Strip off your army-issued fatigues. Abandon the camouflage and machine gun clips. No rush to gun down a full moon orgasm. You've got plenty of time, or so you think. Place a kinder, gentler kiss upon any cheek. Then pray. Grandma doesn't somehow squeeze into those pants.
Great read, Gary. Thank you for the SoundCloud. Very much appreciated. All right, Pam.
All right. Well, I should mention that Gary did not actually write for the contest. However, I read this poem and I thought it fit really well with the topic, even though obviously he takes a more modern approach. It's dark and yet it has that sense of humor to it, that dark, edgy humor. Brilliant imagery, a really modern look at the moment to moment that we live through life, thinking we have so much time. I mean, amazing imagery, hard-hitting lines. He takes a look at everyday life, the blessings we take for granted. You know, when we don't treat each moment like it could be our last. And too oftentimes it does. And I really liked his reference to the Titanic, and there was great references throughout, but the one to Titanic captains focused on enough ice to continue shaking martinis, strip off your army-issued fatigues, abandon the camouflage and machine gun clips, no rush to gun down a full moon orgasm, you've got plenty of time, or so you think. You know, the whole idea that, you know, many of us, including the captain of the Titanic, you know, thought you had plenty of time until we go crashing into that iceberg called death. So great write, clever lines, and very well done.
Nice. Couple lines I thought. Rain, a fickle lover can't be forecasted. Risque dance floor dances practiced in the shower. Then he drops an off-key song, son, meant for nobody overheard. That risque dance practiced in the shower, well, that kind of speaks of death in the moment. And I thought this one was little boys caught fireflies frozen in baby food jars, useless as young women applying makeup before workouts. Yes. Let's cross-contaminate the stupidity of what you're going to do as opposed to how you do it before you get there. I like that. And paying off the stoplight terrorists that don't smear grease on windshield. That's actually quite truthful. I like that. And the Mercedes-driven children, butler served trick-or-treaters at mansion. Ouch. It does hit on the idea of how easy it is to look upon a society and how ugly, immature in the state it is, and how totally irrelevant they are in the moment, because when it happens, they won't know a thing, and it'll just be that note of poof, and you're gone. I like it. Something quiet in that note of, hey, you might have been warned. You knew shit was happening. Yet, you still stayed. Kiss your ass goodbye.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is so true. Great comment, Rick. All right. And up next, we have The Potter Potted by Omnikai. And it goes like this. Scorching ash of hundreds of millions of kilograms in a disregarded routine of wake and sweep, plotted the plots of women and men, lava's sister, miseria of torrid and toiling hot ash, daughter of night Nyx, inurns me into this petrified effigy. You've come to judge the potter potted. I had not plotted my pots and urns when pressure shaped my lungs, prayed and baked human jerky in minutes, entombed for two millennia. Ash glazes of volcanic guts flowed coarse white pumice for 12 dark scorching hours. Antiquity caught fire by Vulcanus blacksmith's hammer. Form me into a man. I, the pot, didn't have a say in potter's plots. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I like the play on the angle, the potter potted, and all the plots in the potter's realm. Nice touch for them. It does offer up that note of how things are and have been found once Pompeii was uncovered. That note to hundreds of millions of kilos of scorching ash, and how it molded itself burnt out the lungs in the moment. Baked the thought of human jerky, apropos, in minutes. Yes, air was so hot that your lungs just singed and burnt in the moment, along with any other moist notes like eyes. And all of a sudden, you're covered in that white pumice and you become the pot in the moment. Kind of eerie thought, offering up the bodies that were found preserved in place. Now they're just as matched as the pots they used to actually make. They are the pots now in Potter's Field. And you know, Potter's Field is that note to that's where usually people are usually buried that have no kin, nobody to pick them up or give them a funeral. So all of Pompeii becomes a Potter's Field. No names, just bodies, graves, in houses, perfect in the moment of death, preserved.
Absolutely. Great observations there, Rex. And yeah, I liked his reference to Potter's Field and the idea of so many of the people, the people killed and buried in Pompeii by the volcano was unrecognizable, unknown. I thought this had powerful lines, strong visceral imagery. The idea of the potter becoming the potted, you know, or the unrecognizable human figure. You know, I thought the way he captured the suddenness of the death worked really well. The clever wordplay, really appreciated the imagery of human jerky in minutes, entombed for two millennia, ash glazes of volcanic guts, flowed coarse white pumice. The idea that history is both preserved and forgotten. So amazing writing, very well done.
Yeah.
And we'll go ahead and try to fit in one more write for the night, and then the rest will be carryovers. And that is The Last Days of Pompeii by A. Shignovsky. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Last Days of Pompeii by A. Shignovsky. The earth began to tremble on the mountain top up high. A gigantic cloud of smoke rose up towards the sky. A noise like rolling thunder was heard for miles around. Then Vesuvius erupted with an ear-splitting sound. A torrent of poison gases descended from the sky. A wave of molten lava meant death for all close by. A raging beast of fire that raced towards Pompeii, devouring all before it, descended on its prey. The sinners and the innocent, the women and the children too, were incinerated in the fire as the magma tore on through. All the streets and buildings were buried by falling debris, and just 2 days thereafter, there was nothing left to see. And post.
Great read there, Rex. A wonderful rhyming poem by A. Shignovsky, who's always spot on with his metered rhyme. He really paints a vivid picture of the eruption of the volcano that showed no mercy to the people of Pompeii. And I like that he reminds us that this wasn't a punishment for sinners alone, but rather like this act of nature where both the sinners and innocent were taken. That's a stanza that particularly stands out to me. The sinners and the innocent, the women and children too, were incinerated in the fire as the magma tore on through. I also really liked how he brought in wonderful attention to detail with the mentioning of the volcano Vesuvius. But also with the he brings in the sounds. A noise like rolling thunder was heard for miles around. Then Vesuvius erupted with an ear-splitting sound. Because there were actually people who either did escape or tried to escape, because it was for, I think, like at least a couple of days or more that the sounds of Mount Vesuvius were heard. The cracking and the you know the noises, the loud noises, but as soon as it did erupt, that's when the deaths came quickly. But there was those precursing trembling and noises that offered up that warning that something was about to happen. So excellent write and very well done.
All right. Yes. That note, that third stanza, tar to poison gases. Between that and the falling rocks, those were the most cause of death for the people in this place. But they didn't get lava in that sense. They did get the poison gases, and they were buried in 20 feet of pumice and ash, which after it cooled, gave them that preserved quality that left them, as you can see them now, mothers with children wrapped in their arms, single people preserved in the moment by themselves. Some did escape. It was a city of some, I think something like 10,000. So there were people that did escape, but the city did not. The entire city was buried under 20 feet of ash and pumice. So it was not a place anyone ever returned to. It's the history of that. It is almost 2,000 years now, 79 AD. So, and it was Vesuvius. That was a one hell of a burst. That's something like it shot itself like 20 miles into the atmosphere and then spread out across the region. And Pompeii wasn't the only place that got affected, but it was the one that got buried. So, nicely done, Shagnovsky. Thank you very much.
It really was, absolutely. Great comment, Rex. You know, I was thinking that it would make more sense to have these carryovers on Thursday, since I've been making people wait so long. And then any carryovers we have from Baudelaire, which was originally supposed to be an after midnight show, we'll put on Tuesday. Does that sound good to you, Rex?
Yep.
All right. Very cool. And by the way, great show tonight.
Yes, a lot of fun. And, well, quite a mix. Tell you what, though.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I do enjoy a good
year. Not much, because I didn't see that on the board. So
very cool. Yep, nice surprise. Surprise! We're going on a wild hunt and all that, and fun.
Well, all right, and I guess. Well, what do you got for tomorrow for Twisted Tuesday?
Well, tomorrow we're making up for the fact that we missed last Tuesday. So the Twisted Tuesdays with the Twisted Sisters are doing International Children's Book Day, poems inspired by quotes from children's authors throughout history. And if you show up for nothing else, people, show up to listen to Intimidus Rex read Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. That's definitely worth a listen.
I forgot about that one.
But you did great on that, Rex. I'm looking forward to hearing that again. So, very cool.
All right, peeps. Have a nice evening, and we'll do this again next Tuesday. So, good night, all.